diving deep into your meditative soul. Feel there the peace and the stillness. Leaving outside all the cares and worries of the day, all thoughts of yesterday and tomorrow, come into your temple of peace, your temple of silence. Bring your full conscious awareness into that inner temple. First, noticing your breathing. Whether you're breathing just on the top part of your lungs or whether you're breathing all the way down into your diaphragm. Without trying to change anything, just be consciously aware. Then notice how you may be holding tension or there may be pain in your body. Or you may feel pleasure or joy. Whatever the state, just simply be aware. Become the keen observer of what is. Going beyond the breath, beyond body sensations, sense for yourself your energy body. That which extends out from your body about the length of your arms to your fingertips. Is it contracted or is it expansive? Is it agitated or is it peaceful? Is it glowing with light or is it of darkness? Again, just simply be the observer of what is. Going beyond the individualized self, experience yourself as being connected to a greater whole, the greater universal consciousness of which you are a part. An indissoluble link ties you to that universal consciousness. As you allow your mind to be released from the individual Atman or the soul, feel as though your mind is expanding into the omniscient mind that is aware and conscious of all of this world and beyond. See yourself in your mind's eye expanding that consciousness until you see this entire solar system. And beyond. Expanding and expanding yourself to see this stellar system, and thousands of stellar systems like it, all like bubbles floating in a vast sea. Go on expanding your consciousness within your mind's eye until you see not only this galaxy, but thousands and thousands of galaxies like it, all floating as bubbles in a sea. You are intimately connected to it, and yet somehow strangely beyond it all. In that connection to the universal omniscient mind, sense within yourself that there is no limit to the expansiveness of your own consciousness. Know yourself to be one with that. Know that whether you are experiencing yourself as the individual Atman, the soul, or the universal Para-Atman, or the universal soul. You are one in the same. But the entire universe exists right within your own being. And you exist within that universe. You are both the particular and the universal. Of this, there is no doubt. In the beginning, it may be an article of faith. But in the end, it is absolute knowledge you come to through spiritual experience. And through this exercise, you can connect yourself with the universal Para-Atman, the universal soul of yourself. And in truth, there is no difference between the Atman, the purity of your soul, and the Para-Atman, purity of the universal soul. For they are both one and the same. Sense your freedom and your universality of that. Make that your unshakable ground, on which worlds and universes may be shaken and fallen, but you stand on that firm ground of absolute knowledge. In the purity of your own soul, let us pray. Oh, Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you,
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Krishna, the great master, Swami Saradananda. From now on, a series of extraordinary changes came over the master's body because of the surge of this devotional love. We have already made mention of the burning sensation in his body from the beginning of his sadhana. He had to suffer on many occasions from its excess. The master himself pointed out its cause to us on various occasions. At the time of performing sandhya and worship, said the master, I used to think, according to the scriptural prescription, that the papa purusha within had been burnt up. who knew then that there was actually a Papa Purusha within the body that could actually be burnt and destroyed? A burning sensation came on the body from the beginning of his sadhana. I thought, what is this disease? It increased by degrees and became unbearable. Various kinds of oils prescribed by the physicians were used, but it by no means alleviated. One day, while I was sitting under the Panchavati, I saw that a jet black person with red eyes and a hideous appearance came reeling, as if drunk, out of this, showing his own body, and walked before me. I saw again another person, a placid man, an ochre-colored dress, with a trident in his hand, similarly coming out of my body. He vehemently attacked the other and killed him. The burning sensation in the body decreased for a short time after I had that vision. I suffered from that burning sensation continually for 6 months before the Papa Purusha was burnt up. We were told by the master that a similar sensation came on him again, a short time after the burning up of the Papa Purusha. The master had gone beyond the limits of Vadi Bhakti, or practice of devotional discipline, according to the scriptural injunctions, and became engaged in the service of the Divine Mother with raga mitika, or loving devotion. In the manner spoken of before, that burning sensation gradually increased so much he could not find relief, even though he placed a wet towel on his head and kept his body immersed in the waters of the Ganga for 3 or 4 hours. We shall describe elsewhere the easy means by which the Brahmani, when she came later, cured it, and pointed out the sensation owed its origin to his longing for the full vision of the Divine Lord and his pain of separation from him. The master suffered again from the burning sensation in his body later, at the time of practicing Madhura Bhava, the sweet mood of spouse of God. Haredi said, the master then suffered from a pain and a burning sensation similar to what one feels when a pot full of live embers is placed on one's chest. He suffered long from that sensation, which came on him from time to time. A few years after his sadhana came to an end, he became acquainted with Kanilal Gosa, a lawyer from Barasat, who was an advanced sadhaka of Shakti. He advised the master to put on his person an amulet encasing the mantra of his chosen ideal. That sensation came to an end when the amulet was put on. The scripture reading comes from the Bhagavad Gita, beginning verses of chapter 5. Arjuna said, Krishna, you extol Sankhya Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, and then yoga of action. Pray tell me, which of the two is decidedly conducive to my good? Sri Bhagavan said, the yoga of knowledge and the yoga of action both lead to supreme bliss. Of the two, however, the yoga of action, being easier of practice, is superior to the yoga of knowledge. Should be ever considered a renouncer. For Arjuna, he who is free from the pairs of opposites is easily free from bondage. It is the ignorant, not the wise, who say that the Sankhya Yoga and Karma Yoga lead to divergent results. For one who is firmly established in either gets the fruits of both. The supreme state, which is reached by the Sankhya Yoga, is attained by the Karma Yoga. Therefore, he alone who sees Sankhya Yoga and Karma Yoga as one, so far as their results go, really sees. Without Karma Yoga, however, Sankhya Yoga, or renunciation of doership in relation to all activities of mind, senses, and body, is difficult to accomplish, whereas Karma Yoga, who keeps his mind fixed on God, reaches Brahm in no time, Arjuna. The Karma Yogi, who has fully conquered his mind and mastered his senses, whose heart is pure, and who has identified himself with the self of all beings, remains untainted even though performing action. The Sankhya yogi, however, who knows the reality of things, must believe, even though seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating or drinking, walking, sleeping, breathing, speaking, answering the calls of nature, grasping and opening, or closing the eyes, that he does nothing, holding that it is all the senses that are moving among their objects. He who acts, offering all actions to God, and shaking off attachment, remains untouched by sin, as the lotus leaf by water. The karma yogis perform action only with their senses, mind, intellect, and body as well, withdrawing the feeling of mind in respect of them and shaking off attachment, simply for the sake of self-purification. Offering the fruit of actions to God, the karma yogi attains everlasting peace in the shape of God realization, whereas he who works with a selfish motive, being attached to the fruit of actions through desire, gets tied down. The self-controlled Sankhya yogi, doing nothing himself and getting nothing done by others, rests happily in God, the embodiment of truth, knowledge, and bliss, mentally regulating all actions to the mansion of nine gates, the body with nine openings. God determines not the doership nor the doings of men, nor even their contact with the fruit of action. But it is nature alone that functions. The omnipresent God does not receive the virtue or sin of anyone. Knowledge is enveloped with ignorance. Hence, it is that beings are constantly falling prey to delusion. In the case, however, of those who said ignorance has been set aside by true knowledge of God, that wisdom, shining like the sun, reveals the Supreme. Those who mind and intellect are wholly merged in Him, who remain constantly established in identity with Him, and finally become one with Him, their sins, being wiped out by wisdom, reach the state whence there is no return. The wise look with the same eye on a Brahmin, endowed with learning and culture, a cow, an elephant, dog, and a pariah too. Even here is the mortal plane conquered by those whose mind is established in unity, since the Absolute is untouched by evil and knows no distinction, hence they are established in the Eternal. I'd like to speak this evening on becoming established in the Eternal. Every one of us are drawn here tonight because we have a yearning, passion for establishing ourselves in the Supreme, Eternal Presence. Perhaps at first it comes with an inner knowing, but it's incomplete. So it is an act of faith that we start upon any spiritual path, hoping, perhaps stronger than hope, yearning for something greater in our lives, somehow knowing, somehow not knowing what it is that we are headed for. With each and every step that we take in the direction of our spiritual sadhana, or our pathway to God, we come into connection with those circumstances that are perfectly designed for us in order to transmute the human into the divine. In truth, the divine has never left us. It is as if you were to look back on your life now and see yourself as a young person, perhaps in elementary school. The elementary school child is a part of who you are now. Its experiences, along with your memories and thoughts of who that person was, the impressions formed upon your conscious and unconscious mind, all become a part of who you are, Yet in the sense that time progresses, you are not a part of who that six-year-old or seven-year-old or eight-year-old was at the time. You are beyond that, so you contain the former, but the former does not contain you. In the same way, you have come from spirit, and in spirit you are perfect, and you manifest the absolute consciousness that is of God. And that spiritual consciousness contains you. But you, in the human self, from the ego standpoint, do not contain the absolute spiritual presence. In order to regain that supreme state of eternal consciousness, we have to go through those experiences that lead us from the human, so to speak, or this individual consciousness, ego consciousness, that is connected with this body, and merges itself into the absolute eternal consciousness. In the visualization that we did tonight, we went through the steps of merging that consciousness through the mind's eye from the individual into the divine. Now, when you do that, and the truth of that experience comes upon you, even as in the visualization, you still felt that you were yourself, only in a much expanded version. And in the same way, when you get that full realization, you don't feel as if you have become somebody else. Rather, you feel as if you have truly become yourself. That the great divorce that happens between the individual Atman, or the soul, and the universal Para-Atman, or the universal self, is nothing but an idea, a delusive thought. And when that delusive thought is overcome, you discover who and what you truly are. Now, when we go upon this earth plane, and we think of ourselves as a small individual trying to make our way upon the spiritual path, or upon the human endeavors, field of human endeavors, we don't sense that we are one with that universal consciousness. We feel as if we are alone somehow, that there is something that is missing in our lives. And this is a built-in mechanism that when we tire of all the things that the world has to offer us, and we see that it is basically a repetition, that no matter how much wealth we get, no matter how many spouses or children or all the other things this world has to offer us, nevertheless, it has a change of names and forms along the way, but there is a sameness about it. And in that sameness, we experience a kind of dullness of spirit, and we reach out and we yearn for something greater. Sri Yukteswar talked about leaving this body and going up into astral consciousness. And there we meet many, many people. People we have known not only in this lifetime, but all of our other lifetimes. Well, needless to say, we meet not only people who are just acquaintances, but we meet mothers and fathers from many lifetimes. We meet children that we've had from many, many lifetimes. We meet spouses and those who we thought we loved especially, and that we had committed our lives to, perhaps. And by meeting many, many of these, we can't decide on who to love especially. You see, so we get confused. What can we do? Because we've had so many mothers. We've had so many fathers. We've had so many lovers. We've had so many husbands. We've had so many wives. And as an individual, we've not even just been exclusively a male or a female, but we've experienced both sexes. And so we can't even become exclusively attached to one sex or the other, but rather we see ourselves as one. Some of the representations of Shiva in India show this by splitting Shiva right down the center. On the left side is the female side, and on the right side is the male side. And so he is the full complement of both male and female. Now, while we reside in a physical body, and we have a male body or a female body, Nevertheless, we have the consciousness or the energy of both the male and the female within us. Now, you may say, in a general context, that the female carries more of the feminine energy with her, and those have certain characteristics. And men and males tend to carry more of the masculine with them. But through balancing our lives spiritually, we can come into a full balance of both the male and the female. Mother was a tremendous example of this. She had the full complement of both male and female. And while she had a feminine body, a female body, she had that feminine energy and she liked it. She didn't believe in kind of merging the sexes together and having a unisex. She liked having a feminine body. She liked having that feminine energy. And she used it to its fullest expression. But she also had a large dose of the masculine energy. And she could be in the prototypical kind of male energy. She could have a lot of that outward energy. She could be very forceful. She had a fine, fine intellect, the greatest that I've ever known. And she had that wisdom nature. But she also had the archetypal feminine aspect, which was she had the love, she had the nurturance, she had the ability to make you feel as if you were her child and that she loved you exclusively. Now, sometimes people hear her talk and they say, oh, she sounds a little harsh. And I realized after a while that she was speaking with the power of God coming through her and the tremendous wisdom. And it has that masculine aspect to it. And what those who listen to the tapes only don't get from her is the hugs that she gave afterwards. Because she would stand at the back of the room and she would give everyone a hug. And you felt as if you were totally encased in that love. I had an interesting experience one time when we were meeting at Bonnie's home. I stood in line waiting for my hug. When I got up to Mother, I gave her a hug and I looked into her eyes and I felt myself as if I were falling into her eyes. And I held myself back. I realized that I just jerked myself back once again. And then I thought, no, this is why I've come. I want to know where she resides, who she is. And so I just felt myself falling and falling and falling. A very unusual experience. And it's one of those experiences. I had no idea how much time elapsed. It may have been brief seconds. It may have been a little longer than that. But this falling sensation occurred, and I just felt myself going with it. And finally, I came with a start right in my own heart center. And it was there that I realized that's where Mother truly resided. It's right within my own heart. And so this great love came about. Now, Mother did her work everywhere and anywhere, and there's no rules that could describe her or that she prescribed to necessarily. One time, this was in the 1970s, and deep dish pizza came into vogue. It hadn't been around before that. So a large group of us decided we had the opportunity, rather, to go out to dinner with Mother, and she wanted to experience. And somehow I ended up being seated next to Mother. And we were eating this pizza. And she had this ability. Sometimes when I was in public with her and we had these lunches, she would be speaking to somebody. And even though I was sitting right next to her, and for all apparent reasons, I should be able to understand everything that she was saying, she had this ability to shield her words from me during that time. And I would even lean in closer to see if I could eavesdrop on what she was saying. No way, the words were somehow indiscernible by me. But she just, as if there was a cocooning shield of energy came around us, and I just felt enveloped in that, and I could feel her whole attention on me. And she looked at me very intently, and she said, "Why don't you love me completely?" Somehow I knew exactly what she was speaking about. And I said, "Well, Mother, years ago I went through a breakup in a relationship, and it caused me a great deal of pain. I hadn't even fully realized it until that moment when she brought it up. But I said, you know, I have not wanted to get hurt like that again. It was so painful to me at the time. She looked at me and she said, unless you can love God fully, you cannot have Him. Well, this was like a bomb going right into the center of my whole being, going off and right in the center, and there's no way for me to ignore it. I knew the truth of what she said, and I had to be able to respond to it. It took me a week or 2 weeks of meditating on it and staying on that, struggling with this seesaw battle going on inside of me as to whether to open myself to loving her and, needless to say, the universal love more completely, or to keep that carefully built wall around my heart. And back and forth I went, and I finally came to the conclusion, enough. I will love completely, and if I get hurt in the process, so be it. Isn't it better to make the decision to love completely rather than to stay behind this wall, which not only keeps the pain out, but it also keeps the good out? And this is how I reasoned with myself. And so inside of myself, I made the decision to dissemble that wall and to open myself to love her completely. One of the interesting plays of Mother is that years later I was telling her that story, and she feigned not remembering it at all, which she may not have in human sense. But when I told her that, she says, oh, did I say that to you? That was as if I was rather bold to do that, wasn't I? And this is the way that she played with all of us. And it was a wonderful play indeed. But it was a pinnacle moment in my own spiritual development, because if I had not made that choice, I know very definitely within me that I could not have continued to make progress, and I would have stayed stuck. You know, there are many things that come into our life. Each one of them are perfectly designed for us, and that is particularly true when we have made our stated intention to practice this sadhana, this pathway to God. Every situation that comes before us is either a test, or it is information for us, or it is a teaching of some nature. And everything that comes into our lives can be looked at in this way, that we have to encounter the divine again and again and again. And it is not that God withholds himself from us, for that infinite, omniscient, all-powerful consciousness is never withholding itself to us. But rather, it is the successive layers of ignorance that we have built with our own hands, even in times unremembered, that bring us into this encapsulated state where we live in ignorance of our oneness with that consciousness. And fear comes up, anger comes up, lust comes up, greed comes up, and they challenge us to take us back into the encapsulated world of the ego. And it is only by rooting our consciousness firmly in the divine, with courage and steadfastness, willing to brave whatever comes. And it is not necessarily that we do it perfectly. It is not usually the case that the sadhaka, or that one who is the spiritual aspirant, does everything perfectly. But the greater question is, do we learn from our experience, and do we get back on the path if we make a mistake? Mistakes will occur. But the main thing is that steadfastness, the steadiness of mind, the determination, always keeping forward in our thoughts, our intentions, Now, most of us make this path much more difficult than it needs to be, because we get caught up in the seesaw battle. Do I really want this, or do I want something else? Do I really want to go straight to God, or do I want to just settle for some things in my life now? Now, there is nothing in this world or in this life that is not of God. So situations and people are not necessary, it is not necessary to exclude them out of our lives by virtue of the fact that it is lacking the presence of God. But rather it is because of our own intuition. We know that that person or that situation is not in accordance with our spiritual sadhana. And we know that if we continue our association and moving down that path, that we will fall off the straight and narrow. That is the most expedient means for coming into our life being. So we make decisions every day, moment by moment, and it is our thought that is the first creative principle. Where do our thoughts dwell? What do they dwell on? What is the result of that dwelling? Now, all of us need to earn a living in this world, and we need to get through this world doing a variety of activities, whether that's work or family or friends. So it is not necessary for us to withhold ourselves. As Krishna says in the reading tonight, the Gita and the Gita, that the karma yogi is the one who can make the easier progress, because for most people to try to withdraw from the world and just to take their attention and focus it on God, everything comes at you all at once, and you find you can't concentrate on God at all. So it is better to be in the world, but not of it, and to continue to practice that. And through that practice, you eventually get better at it. You avoid the snares that the world has to offer you. And you begin to feel that certitude within your own being. You know, most people feel that certainty, that certitude, right starting with the stomach and going right up to the heart center, right up into perhaps all the way out to the top of the head, perhaps just up to the neck center. So basically, in the heart center, they feel their soul, their sense of self. And when they feel right about things, when they feel good about things, when they feel strong in their soul and their spirit, they feel a certainty right in the heart center. Now, if you observe yourself when you've gotten off track and your thoughts are scattered and your energy is scattered, you feel frayed at the edges. You feel as if yourself is all out there on the edges of your aura or this light body of which you are part. And so, just like a centrifuge, where scientists put some essences, a variety of materials, and they start spinning the centrifuge. And in some cases, what they're looking for is right at the center, and all the dross, all the unwanted materials get spun out to the far edges. And that which is right in the center is the purity of what they're looking for. In the same way, your sadhana will begin to pick up this centrifugal force within you, and it will start to spin out that dross to the outer edges. Now, if you're attached to those things, your consciousness will spread out with it, and suddenly you'll feel you're all out on the edges. And your energy will be frayed, and you'll feel out of sorts. You'll feel unbalanced. But if you keep your consciousness centered, right in the midst of the center point of the centrifuge, then that purity of consciousness becomes more and more solid. It begins to grow. And so in this life, you keep your consciousness here at the heart center. You operate out of there. And you keep yourself focused. And through that practice, you grow in that centeredness. And then you don't identify with all those activities that draw you outward, outward, outward. And they destroy your peace. They destroy that openness to your own guidance because you're drawn and attracted by everything out there. The compass that determines your direction is right here, right in the midst of you, right in the center of you. And if you just try to please everybody else in your life, that becomes your compass. And so one time your setting is over here and another time over there, and it gets scattered just depending on who you're around, and you totally lose yourself. But if you keep that compass centered right inside of you, then your direction is sure, and it's steady, and it's certain. And gradually, that sadhana begins to distill itself, and that fire grows up inside of you, and that is the fire of the kundalini. And it begins to burn out all the dross, and that is part of the purification also. And you keep yourself cool during that time. It's very important. Fortunately, we have ice in this part of the country. And it's very important to keep yourself cool if that happens, because otherwise you can do damage through the destruction of the electrolytes within your system. And gradually you can, as I say, do damage to your nervous system and to your brain system. And that is counterproductive, of course. So you want to keep yourself cool. You want to keep your thoughts cool. And you do that by keeping them on God. And gradually this fire burns through the dross, and burns through the dross, and burns through the dross. And when the dross is completely destroyed, then the fire leaves, because there's no more pure force, see? And what before was creating this fire that was burning this dross, it's just pure spiritual light and energy. It goes up your spine into the higher regions of your brain and emanates out from your whole being. Now, different aspects of the sadhana can be painful and be difficult, but it's all part of the pathway back to God. And what we need is a steady mind that is purposeful, that has decided its intention. And that requires maturity, mental, emotional maturity. And that is something that is essential to develop along the way. And we do it by practice. And we do it by clarifying what our purpose is, by clarifying who we are, and keeping that compass centering right in our own being. And this is the way that leads to our own supreme consciousness. And we come to the end of our sadhana by that complete and whole realization of the supreme self within. And then we look back on all the experiences and we think, thank God. Thank God that these elemental forces with the supreme divine consciousness came into my being and created all the conditions necessary for my sadhana. And that I was doing nothing but facing myself, time and again, time and again. And when I wanted to say, God, why have you created such a rotten world? And why have you made all these things so difficult? That we realized that it wasn't the supreme consciousness, but it was this individualized consciousness that created everything that we were facing, and that it was of our own doing. And you know, like good children, we have to clean up our own mess. And unless we do so, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. But we get help. We get help. That divine consciousness comes in, and it helps us. And we could not do it without that. Years ago, I believe the year was 1976, I was traveling in London. And it was during a time of very intense sadhana for me. And I had purchased some a ticket to go across the channel over to Amsterdam. As I walked away from the ticket office where I had purchased these tests, I noticed that the date was wrong that they had put on it. I went back to the ticket office, and it was just 5 minutes after six. They closed at six, and I knocked on the door. They were all in there working at their desk, but the door was locked. And they pointed at the clock, indicating that the time was past for when they would entertain any customers. And I held up my ticket to the window, and I said, "You put the wrong date on there." They wouldn't move from their desk. They wouldn't open the door. And for some reason, as is the case during sadhanas, many strange things happen, and I just burst into tears. And I was wandering the streets of London, really inconsolable. I had no idea where I was walking. And the tears were pouring down. And I just felt so alone, and I felt so disconsolate. And to the point where I just was in this haze. And suddenly, I felt as if an arm came across my shoulders, and I was startled. I looked around, and there was no physical presence there. But there is a definite weight and presence on my shoulders. And in my mind's eye, I saw this arm of light across my shoulders and giving me comfort and support. And suddenly it transformed an experience that had just been devastating in one moment. And in the next moment, it was uplifting, and I felt so taken care of. I felt so comforted in that. So wherever you go in this world, there is that presence, and that's what it means that God is equally present everywhere. There is no place that you can go if this presence is not there. I think I've told the story before when I was in the Sahara Desert and traveling there. And it was in the mid-afternoon one day, and I smelled Mother's perfume. She wore this one perfume called White Lilac. And I smelled her perfume so clearly, and for minutes it was there. Well, as I said, I've been traveling in the Sahara, and I hadn't taken any showers. And I know the Arabs that I was traveling with hadn't taken any showers. I knew it wasn't any of us who were exuding such a sweet fragrance. And it was so wonderful to be in a distant place and to smell that perfume, and it just brought her presence so close and so near. Brought that presence so close and so near. And so this is the promise that we have from all of our life masters, living embodied in a physical being or not. And I've had many, many experiences with all these masters that prove to me beyond a shadow of doubt that they are a living and very real presence. Now, sometimes people say, I don't know. I see these pictures of the saints and different people and images of God and some of the devotees' homes. Do I need to have that too? And the answer is no. That for some people, that relationship and that presence is strengthened through reminders such as things such as this. And for others, it's an internal connection, and the exterior is not unnecessary thing. So there's no right or wrong around that. It's simply what invokes within you the feeling of the Supreme, what helps to remind you of that eternal presence. And for some, it is pictures, some others, it is statues, some others, it is repeating the name of God. But whatever it is, make it something that endears God to you, that makes God feel as if it is an indispensable presence in your life. And make it feel as if it is close as your nearest and next breath, as close as your next thought, as close as the next sensation or feeling coming through your body. And when you see that it is the divine intelligence and life that is responsible for every feeling, for every thought, for every breath that you take, then you are very close to the kingdom of heaven that's in you. And it is coming through a purification of the mind. It gradually gets purified. That this becomes an ongoing remembrance and an ongoing presence within you. And this ever new, ever expanding, ever joyful presence is the kingdom of heaven within you. And that your life is guided moment to moment by our presence. And you never experience separation again. Rather, it is the fullness of your oneness with the divine presence. I want to just stop there and see if there are any questions about the talk tonight, about practicing your own sadhana that have come up in the last week.
David, I'd like to tell the people about what happened regarding George. Is it George Jackson or George Johnson at the Song of the Morning Ranch? I felt very strongly internally directed that evening that he first met you to introduce you, and you had gotten up from the dinner table and walked out to the balcony. And so I introduced you and we had a little conversation going there. And he kept smelling incense. And he was downwind of you because the wind was blowing off the lake. Mm-hmm. But that was remarkable. Mm-hmm. And he remarked on it several times. Right? Mm-hmm. It was just because it was undeniable, unmistakable to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, he knew it was coming directly from you. There was nothing upstream of him. It's an interesting, odd story. I don't know what it means. Wonderful.
It happened on many occasions.
Drew his attention to it.
No idea what the meaning is. All part of God's plan. It's the wonderful thing as you learn to trust and live in that consciousness is that there's nothing for you to worry about. God is the doer, and you feel as if you are just a witness to everything that's done to you. And there's no trouble with feeling arrogant or egotistical because the more that happens, the more you realize it's absolutely out of your own control. You have no knowledge of it. You have nothing other than to just be in awe of all the things that God does. It's the most fascinating, interesting life.
My only question is, how do you get from A to Z?
That's a big question.
might take
a few more of these sessions.
Well, it's called learning your ABCs. It is, in one sense, it can feel like a long, long journey. And in another sense, God is as great and as full in you right this moment as that presence has ever been. And that there is nothing that separates you in reality from that presence. So is sometimes, because we're used to being the doer, we think we need to create something. We think we need to make something happen. But as Papa said so often to Mother, Mother, don't be like the baby monkey who's clinging to the mother's neck, jumping from branch to branch, because oftentimes the monkey falls and hurts itself. Be rather like the baby kitten who sits on the ground and meows for its mother. If in this moment you can open yourself to the divine perfection that exists within you already, it's not a matter of creating it, it's not a matter of becoming it, it's not a matter of traveling to it. It's simply being it. And you are in truth and in reality already that. And accept it in whatever form it deems to come to you in this moment. Now, that may be something that feels very familiar to you. It may be the form that you're most comfortable with, the sense capacity that you have in this moment, that who you are is God in human form. And never let that thought leave you. So that every experience that you have is God experiencing its life through you. However limiting, however frail, however we judge it to be as being different from God, give no power to that, that it's separate from God at all. Accept yourself fully as a manifestation of divine consciousness. And you see, there's nothing new in that. There's nothing to create. There's nothing to become. You are that. And by accepting it, you create an opening within your own consciousness as a link towards that divine consciousness. And if you just do that one thing and stay in that remembrance to the best of your ability, then God will do everything else. God is a respecter of our own individual will. And we've given so many messages, I want to do this, I desire this. And we're like this little two-year-old whose mother is going, here, let me help. No, you know, let me do it. I want to do it. Mm-hmm. God says, all right, you know, you give it a try. But the moment we say, God, you help me. I've made a total mess out of this. I have no idea how to pick up the pieces to this one. And that divine intelligence comes in and starts working on our behalf. And it's our invitation. And we just keep issuing that invitation again and again and again. And don't assume that whatever level of consciousness you're in is separate from that. That is God manifesting itself through. And it is coming to you in a way that you can understand. If God came into you in its full splendor and light, it would be so overwhelming to the consciousness that we would simply blank out. We wouldn't be able to go with it. So we have to grow gradually. Not because there's any limit to divine consciousness, but because the way we constructed our own consciousness has created a limitation in us. And so gradually we expand, and then we contract. We kind of go back into old lifestyles and go, well, why do I do that? You know, why does that happen? Well, it's because we've had enough of that growth for a moment, and we just kind of want to return back to where we feel familiar at. And so we grow again, and we contract again. And we grow once again, and we contract again. But each time we do that, we grow out a little bit more, and we contract a little bit less. But because we say, this is me, we don't even recognize the difference. Because, well, that's how it is. You feel it as a continuous sameness about it, even though it's growing each time. Because it feels so natural. Now, the expansiveness sometimes feels very unnatural, really stretches us. And so we just yearn to get contracted again. And we say, oh, I felt some consciousness. That was so wonderful. What in the world would have possibly drawn me back into that? But it's our own unconscious need for that familiarity. But gradually, as we do that, and so God is expanding. And whether you realize it or not, you are a much different person than a year ago, or 2 years ago, or 10 years ago. And if you could see it, you would know. Now, because the psychological material seems very much the same, I'm still struggling with the same things here. We feel the sameness of it. But the reality is, we've grown a huge amount. So accept all of that. And through that acceptance, there's a saying that all who received the Christ gave he the power for them to become the sons of God. That's not an exact quote, it's a paraphrase. But to receive, to open yourself to receive. And all the tension in sadhana is our reluctance to receive. And when we just open ourselves, when I made that decision to love completely, it didn't happen all just in a moment, but I made that decision. My purpose became clear. Now that took time and time and time to really open myself. And I'm still working on this and opening. the moment that I made that change. And so that turned a corner. So in this same way, this can be a moment for all of us to make that deep internal decision to open ourselves and to receive the purity of consciousness in that light, whatever the cost, without measure. And it's scary because we don't know what the cost is going to be. But it's just like anybody starting a positive endeavor. They don't know what it's going to do. But they never look back and say, I wish I would have stayed in Podunkville.
Right.
Whatever it came of, they're glad they took the risk. Because not to do that would be not to grow. So from getting to A to Z is accept Z. Accept the whole gamut, just like a symphony orchestra playing in you. And however God chooses to express himself in you, accept that that is God in your life being the doer, and you are simply the witness. That's not hard.
No. Being a spectator is usually not hard.
It's the lazy man's way to enlightenment.
Sounds like a good book.
I once was listening to a consultant for looking at efficiency around the workplace and that kind of thing. He says, anytime I go into an organization, I look for the smartest and the laziest person in the place. And they'll always find the most efficient way to do things. So we don't need to be lazy, but we can be efficient.
Just passively wait for God to come to you is what I feel that you're saying, rather than striving.
Well,
and, but I'm thinking,
I don't want to imply that it's passive in the sense that when you're being very active in the sense of being awake and aware, it's not just simply saying, well, I don't need to expend any effort here. But the effort is in internalizing your consciousness and attuning yourself to divine consciousness, and then to the greatest ability on your level to work in concert with that consciousness. So in that sense, it's an act of love. But it's not the reaching out and grasping. I need to go out and find God. I need to make this happen. I need to create a divine sense of myself. But rather, your work is in being receptive. And that's no mean task. But also to see God as the doer. But you yourself are doing everything in your power to open yourself to that doership working through you. So in a sense, you know, the difficulty of these things, that it's the paradox. Everything that can be said for one side of things, you can say for the other side of things. So, in one sense, it is being the receptive one, and you're observing what is happening through you, but that takes a great deal of attention. And on the other hand, you're seeing what is really the mover inside of you being the doer, and you're not the doer. And on one hand, it's the razor's edge, and you use every ounce of your will to make it happen. On the other hand, everything is done for you and through you. So everything that I could say about the path on one side, I could equally say on the other side.
So it's all happening simultaneously.
It's all happening simultaneously.
So how do you explain Mataji urging Mother to ask Papa over and over again for God realization?
Yes, why not?
you have a strong will and you're used to making things happen in this world, you know that your advice on being letting God come in is good advice.
Mm-hmm. It's both. We're both doing our very level best. But look at the nature of what you commented on. Mother was asking Papa for realization, and Mataji was egging her on. Now, in one sense, she's being a very strong personality and using her will by pestering Papa for realization. That's an active thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But look at what she's requesting. She's requesting Papa to do it for her. You can't escape the paradox.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite paradoxes is the idea that Gandhi was using the threat of violence through his nonviolent means, in that people knew that if he died from a fast, there'd be mass violence in the streets, and that's what made his life so of paramount importance to everybody concerned. And he had to know that. He had to know that that was the motivating factor. So the man who preached absolute ahimsa, nonviolence, was using the threat of violence to bring people together for a peaceful purpose. In this material world, there is no way to escape the paradox. And that's why the mind, the human mind, is incapable of knowing God, because God contains both sides of the paradox. And we can only identify with one side or the other at any moment in time. It's only in the universal omniscient consciousness that we contain simultaneously both sides. And that's where we kind of rest, in that supreme consciousness. And that's how we attain to
that. But we're supposed to come at rest when we meditate.
Yes.
And I have a real difficulty with that in terms of I want very hard to reach that point.
Yeah.
And I try my hardest to get there, but it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So what do I need to do more to bring myself to that place? So I can't make it happen, I have to wait for a state of grace for it to happen?
You can maintain an awake and aware state and open yourself to the grace coming in you. So rather than running after, you know, Master's beautiful poem where he closed his eyes and he saw the burning candle, and as he saw the taper, he ran toward it, wanting to get with everything in him. And the harder he ran after it, the more it receded from him. This happened time and again. Finally, he got it. Saw the burning taper. He remained quiet and got even more quiet. And the more quiet he got, the stronger the candle burned, until finally it was blazing inside of his consciousness. So at one hand, it's an active participation in meditation. We're bringing the mind back. We're bringing the mind back. We're being aware. But in another sense, in ourselves, or through our own will, through our own volitions, we cannot make realization happen. We can merely receive it. We can accept it by being awake, by being aware, by making our intention clear that this is what we want.
So that aspect of it, the control of that, is up to God when he gives you the next step.
Yes.
So you just have to wait.
You get yourself to the door. It's up to God to open the door. Those who knock, I will open the door. You will come in and sup with me and I with them.
Well, I was
the Christ consciousness opens the door. But we get there, and we get ourselves to the door, and we knock. After that, we have to surrender, we have to let it go. It's out of our hands. But we stay there. There's a story of a Tibetan, sometimes they take these yogis or these lamas at very early ages. He was 7 years old. His father delivered him in front of the monastery, and there he sat brought him into the monastery. Now, we might say that's a cruelty to do that to a young child. This soul was prepared for, and there they sat, waiting for days. No food, no water, nothing. And finally they came out, and then he was accepted.
Well, I understand the concept that you have to, I'm kind of boring. I understand the concept that you have to surrender your desire in order to receive your desire, because life shows to be here all the time. I didn't get this till I wanted it for so long, and then I finally gave up, and then I gave up and got it. So I know it's a law of life that happens that way. So I tell God, okay, I want you, but I can't put a stranglehold on you, so I have, but how can you honestly say, well, then I don't want you? I mean, how do you release the desire?
You don't say, I don't want you. You say, I want you, and you have instilled that desire in me. And it is indeed you who are awakening yourself within me. And it is by your power that I even have the desire to want you. And it is by your power that I have the capacity to stay on this path. And it is by your power and by your will that I can, by your agreement, by your willingness, accomplish the goal of this realization. So while you experience that will as coming through you, nevertheless you see it as coming through you, not from you. So you take no sense of the ownership, even though that desire is being expressed through you. And here I sit. Not of my own volition, not of my own power, but because you have willed it. And I will sit until you will for something else for me to do. And that is all I know. And my mind cannot grasp any more than that. So I do what I do because I feel an injunction to do it. And that's all that we can do. And that's everything. Because once we let go of the idea of doership, and it doesn't go easy, that is what most of sadhana is about. Trying. And then finally saying, I can't do it. But not just mentally just saying, I can't do it. On some deep level, it's not mine to do it. I've delivered myself to the door. It's up to the Supreme Consciousness to open that. So, we turn our face to God, but even more importantly, God turns his face to us. What we do is a small little percentage, but it's essential. We don't do it, the rest doesn't happen.
Right.
So we have to do our part. But recognize by what power realization comes. It does not come by our own injunction. It comes because the Supreme Consciousness has decided to awaken itself in us. And it's inspiring us and it's giving us the power to do that. Closing prayer.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of
thy glorious presence. In every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.